Are we going to begin now? Please silence your cell phones. And we're going to have Mincha and Mariv after this downstairs in the base medrash. Sara Tzipora, Bat Shalom Yehuda, was a beautiful, intelligent, loving, caring, and capable woman. She was bubbly, vivacious, gregarious, and greeted everyone with an infectious smile. She excelled in school and in the workplace and connected with her fellow students, employers, and colleagues. Everyone who knew her recognized her strong personality, her contagious laughter, her loyalty to friends, coworkers, and family, her work ethic, and fun-loving nature. We love Sarah very, very much. We will miss her every day for the rest of our lives. We are doing our best to preserve her memory in other ways as well. The Sarah Edelman Memorial Fund is a 501c3 organization designed to help Orthodox children in the St. Louis area in need of counseling, to increase awareness of depression, and to help everyone recognize the warning signs of suicide. To that end, we are going to have a program in the schools this coming school year. We're working on programming that now. We also use some of the funds to help local families defray the costs of their weddings. Thank you to all the donors to the fund. The program lists all the names of people that donated this time. If I have forgotten anyone, please forgive me. With your contributions, we have been able to provide counseling for an increasing number of children in our community. We have also helped fund several weddings. Thank you to David Markowitz, who again provided the sound system, and to Pat Fogel and Bobby Gibley for their assistance this evening. Thank you all for coming. Your financial support to the fund, as well as your love, support for our family, have kept us going. Now I would like to introduce Professor Naomi Nechama Clapper. Professor Naomi Nechama Clapper is the chair of the psychology department of Lander College for Women in Manhattan. Professor Clapper is also the clinical counselor for Lander College's counseling services and is a licensed psychotherapist. Professor Clapper, has taught at the college level for over 25 years, having held positions at Yeshiva University, Sy Sims, and Touro College. In addition, she maintains a private practice in Manhattan's Upper West Side, where she offers individual therapy, premarital counseling, and couples counseling. Professor Clapper's topic today is making marriage work in current times. Nechama, thank you.
Firstly, I'd like to thank the Edelman family for inviting me to come out and join the community of St. Louis as we gather together with one heart to commemorate the special neshama of Sarah. The title, Making Marriage Work in the 21st Century, is actually a confusing title. I know I chose it, but it's a confusing title. After all, shouldn't the techniques that make a marriage work be something that makes a marriage work in any century, in any generation? But research shows that there are some very special challenges in the 21st century to couples today. Research talks about the escalating expectations on young men who have more competition for graduate school, longer work hours than previous generations, the intensity in the job market, but also the expectations to share more family responsibilities than ever before. And the same research discusses the escalating expectations on young women who are married today. Not only do they face the same intense pressure in the job market and the same competition, but they also have both internal and external standards to try and match what they saw in their homes in previous generations, even though their mothers and grandmothers may not have been first year law associates or medical school residents with the same long hours. And the research discusses the current financial crisis and its impact on family dynamics, the stress of conflicting needs and its impact on the family, the dual careers. In my practice now, I see many couples who have marriages that span different countries. Some live in Israel, some live in working in America and commuting. They span different states. Some of them are going to graduate school in different states and trying to meet on weekends, and the stressors that that creates. And if we really analyze the problem, we really wouldn't have time to discuss the solution. Therefore, today we are going to discuss things that make marriage work, to learn facets that we can implement today that might be pivotal in our own relationships that we can take home with us. So what makes marriage work? What makes marriage work? And I ask the same question as you do. I don't feel that I'm in a different place. I'm in the same trench as everyone else. I work as a professor of psychology for the last 29 years, and I see students. One semester, they're taking my class as newlyweds. The next semester, as a young divorcee. And I ask, what makes marriage work? I ask the question as a licensed therapist with a practice in Manhattan since the 1980s, as I try and combat through premarital counseling and marriage counseling this escalating divorce rate that we see alarmingly in the Jewish community. And I ask, as someone who's been married for over 32 years, as we see so many of our friends and so many of our children's married friends getting divorced. We have seen, all of us, so many couples with a lot in common and so much nachas, and somehow their marriage doesn't seem to go the distance. And then we see other couples who are so different that you would have never thought to set them up. You would have never thought to put them together, and they're celebrating their differences 50 years, 60 years down the line. So if having a lot in common does not guarantee a long marriage, what makes marriage work? Psychology is a science of research. There's an amazing in-depth research project done by Dr. John Gottman and Bob Levinson. And the research was done in the University of Berkeley, California. Because what other state would fund a research project about love and marriage for 35 years but California? And the research project studied 300 couples, and they studied them for over 35 years. The lab was a bed and breakfast that they set up, and the same couples would come every year and hang out for a few days. The couples included childhood sweethearts, couples that met on the internet, couples that had dated or lived together for many years, and even arranged marriages. There were no yeshivish or Hasidish couples, but they did have some couples whose parents went to India, handpicked the spouses for their children, brought them back, and they met a few days before the wedding. And this lab was an ordinary bed and breakfast. The only difference was that there were four cameras bolted onto the walls, recording their every movement. And there were belt monitors that measured electrocardiograms. And when they checked in, they had to give blood samples to see how their immune system was doing and how their stress level was. There were people in the other room recording every facial expression from the cameras. Otherwise, it was just like an ordinary bed and breakfast. Imagine the embassy suites run by the KGB. That's what it was like. And researchers collected data and studied the same couple for three decades. And they followed them in their newlywed years as they were working out the work-life balance and being married. And they followed them through their childbearing years when they were working out different parenting styles and stressors from having little children. And they followed them into their midlife and all that that entails. And they found that some couples got divorced, and many couples stayed together but were not happy. And some couples, their marriages got better and more satisfying as the years went on. And they called that group the Masters of Relationships, because it's California, so they want a good sound bite, so they called them the Masters of Relationships. I see in my practice in Manhattan that there are many couples who are married, but staying married is not a way to measure marital satisfaction, because many of those people feel stuck in a relationship that is unhappy and becomes a pattern over many years. Researchers tried to find out if there was anything different about the group who stayed and got happier as the years went on, so they could figure out what correlates to a lasting, happy relationship, and hopefully even apply those principles. Over time, they found they could predict with 90% accuracy which couples would be happy and stay together or which couples would break up. 90% accuracy. In psychological testing, it is very hard to predict behavior. We all know, we have children, many of us, right? It's very hard to predict their behavior, and we raised them. So you can't imagine a study that can predict something with 90% accuracy. And one of the reasons it's hard to predict is because we don't control the variables. If you think your child is going to be happy in camp, you can't predict if being homesick is going to ruin their experience, or you think they're going to be happy in a certain college, and then they go and you don't know who their friends are going to be, and that will affect their experience. And yet in this lab, they certainly didn't control the variables. The couples went back to their normal life, and all the normal life stressors, or perhaps atypical stressors, they couldn't control who would lose their job and become ill and all the other issues. And yet, just from these markers, they could predict who would stay together and become happier as the years went on and which marriages would fall apart. To the point that they could watch a couple in the lab for 30 minutes and predict with 90% accuracy who would split up. And they used these markers to make principles about what made relationships work and what weakened them. We'll discuss some of them tonight and hopefully be able to increase some of the positive behaviors in our own relationships. In this lab at Berkeley, they found that couples who had a long-lasting relationship had a ratio of positive behaviors to negative behaviors that was 5-1, meaning there were many more overall positive behaviors in their relationship with each other than negative behaviors. Luckily, positive behaviors are very simple things. Not acts of heroism, no grand presents, nothing altruistic, just simple kindness. Showing empathy for each other, expressing, oh, I hear it sounds like you had a very hard day at work, listening, being affectionate verbally and physically, calling during the day, not to tell the other person what to bring on their way home from work, but just to see how their day was. Positive behaviors included what Jonathan Gottman called bids for attention. Positive bids for attention. When someone tries to tell you something, if you stop what you're doing and look at them and pay attention, making eye contact, responding to them, that's considered a positive behavior. What did the research say for negative behaviors? Well, not all negative behaviors, it turns out, are equally destructive. The four most destructive behaviors in this research are what the researchers called apocalypses of marriage. And they were criticism, stonewalling, sarcasm, and contempt. Stonewalling is when you give someone the silent treatment and you don't look at them, you hold a grudge. These were considered the really most destructive negative behaviors. But of all these negative behaviors, contempt or disrespect was the greatest predictor of divorce. It's similar to the Rambam that teaches in marriage, respect is more important than love. The research of 35 years showed that disrespect corroded marriage above all. This means that love couples who were really fabulously in love when they got married and went to this lab year after year, they found if they were often contemptuous or disrespectful to each other, their marriage wouldn't last. But the arranged marriages, if they had been taught to treat each other respectfully and be kind to their partner, that they were more likely statistically to have a marriage that grew and grew to be more and more satisfying. This ratio of 5 positive behaviors to offset every 1 negative behavior is a huge marker of stability of divorce in the 300 couples. It suggests that if you do something to hurt your partner, you have to make up for it with many, ideally 5, positive behaviors. It suggests that negative has the ability to inflict harm much more than positive has to do good. It implies that we need a marriage that is a full climate of affection and humor and intimacy and fun, and it needs to be constant. The couples who had more negative than positive, even though they were real love matches and newlyweds, ended up divorcing. And surprisingly, the couples who had an equal ratio of negative and positive, their marriages also didn't last. The masters of relationships had built a climate of positive behaviors, a climate that Dr. Gottman called fondness and admiration, communicating respect and affection in small ways, small things, and doing it often. Messages that say, thank you, I was thinking of you, I respect you. What I find ironic in my practice is that many times I see couples who will think positively about the other spouse. They will say to me when they're alone with me, my husband has much more patience with our teenager than I do. Or, my wife was the best first date I ever had. But it is clear when the couple is together in my office that they have never told each other these positive things. The fundamental aspect about building intimacy is that it can't stay in your brain. It can't be implied. You have to tell them. It has to come out. And the masters are doing this and doing this often. Even trivial things like doing the dishes. After dinner, when one of you goes upstairs and puts the kids to sleep, and you come down to the kitchen, and your partner has loaded the dishwasher or done the dishes, do you remember to thank them? Now, when I am conducting marital counseling, I often hear, why should I thank him? I do stuff, he does stuff. He doesn't thank me for everything. And then they proceed to tell me with alarming accuracy all the things that they haven't been thanked for recently. And it's clear that people do not like feeling unappreciated. If we build a climate of fondness and admiration, it becomes a habit of mind. We are scanning the environment, looking for the positive things to focus on and thank people for. It's very similar to the positive parenting that we all try and do, where we try and catch our kids doing something good, to reinforce the positive, to focus on the positive. Well, this is something that works well with our spouses too. So here's a challenge for you all tonight, a little self-study that might be very eye-opening for you. I dare you to go home tonight and find five red or colored pieces of paper and put them in one pocket. These are the 5 negative behaviors that you're limited to for the next 24 hours. Now, if you have 5 negative behaviors that you're limited to, how many positive behaviors do we need to offset that? 25. 25, right? The head of the statistics department here at the... Thank you. Thank you so much. 25 positive behaviors. So we need to take 25 white index cards or white pieces of paper and fold them up and put them in the other back pocket. Those are the 25 positive behaviors that you want to practice that day. You are going to be surprised how quickly you pull out those red cards. Like red flags in soccer, right? The red cards. It could be any colored paper if you don't have red cards. I could see at CVS they'll say there was a run on red index cards this week. But criticism and correcting are considered negative behaviors. If you say, you said what? Were you spent that? Or are you really wearing that to the lecture at the synagogue tonight? Those are considered red flags. And you need many positive behaviors to offset that. Why don't you see for yourself what your ratio is of positive behaviors to negative behaviors in your marriage? And it's important to focus on both the positive things they say, but also the behaviors that they do. Now, I know many of you have read this best-selling book called The Five Languages of Love, and it's really a separate discussion. But in the book, it basically tells us that there are different languages of love. Some people are very loquacious, and they like to give compliments and say thank you and tell you how terrific you are. But other people's languages of love are doing. They're not so good with the compliments or remembering to say thank you. Very often it's cultural. It's a culturally given behavior. But they'll let you take the one Shabbos afternoon nap because the kids are crazy and only one of you can lay down. Or they will leave you the parking spot that they want. Or they will do the dirtier job that they know you hate doing in the house without you begging them to do it. So we need to learn and appreciate the other person's love language, because those things that they do are also positive behaviors. One might think from this study that the therapists wanted to eliminate all negative behavior, anger, sadness, but that's not true. First of all, it's completely unrealistic. We all mess up, we all get critical. I tell couples in my practice who have a hard time and are holding a grudge, I say, you know, Hashem himself created Adam and Chava, and they messed up, and they fought with him, so we are allowed to mess up. Secondly, negativity is productive in relationships. Negativity helps us call out what doesn't work for our partner. If you hurt your partner's feelings, you can learn something from that. You can talk about how to make it better next time. It's a learning vehicle. In close relationship, we inherit all emotions, sadness, disappointment. The key is what you learn at that time. After every fight, ask yourself what you learned about your partner. Not using sarcasm, not something like, oh, I learned never to invite your family for a barbecue. Something positive that you learned that you can apply for next time. There is productive fighting, and there is unproductive or destructive fighting. Fighting that causes damage in a relationship. From this experiment, we learned something crucial about avoiding destructive fighting. I told you that they collected data about the couple's physiology when the people interacted. When your heart rate climbs over 100 beats a minute, your body switches automatically into fight or flight. You cannot control it. It's automatic. It's part of our autonomic nervous system. I know there's a lot of data about biofeedback, but biofeedback just helps you calm down. It teaches you how to self-soothe, but it can't prevent your body from getting revved up. So when you start to fight, your body automatically, your adrenal glands start secreting cortisol and adrenaline into your bloodstream, and your arteries start constricting, and your blood flow shuts down in the gut and the kidneys and goes to the muscles, your blood pressure increases, you start sweating more, and you can feel it when you're in a fight. We know when we're in fight or flight. Our fists clench up, our heart races. Sometimes your voice gets louder, harsher. We start sounding a little more like our parents did when they were angry, right? We may slam things without realizing or without meaning to. Now, this in psychology is called flooding. Adaptive when escaping from a predator or when having to flee, but not adaptive at all when you're fighting with your spouse. It's maladaptive because you cannot listen effectively when you're flooded. You cannot think creatively when you're flooded. You can't be a good problem solver when you're flooded. People have to calm down. People have to self-soothe. In the lab, the observers experimented with this. When the couples were fighting, when their heart rate went over 100 beats a minute, they would come in and say, please, we're having trouble with the equipment. No talking. Just go into the corner, read a magazine, and we'll let you know when our equipment are finished. Really, it wasn't true. They just wanted to see the discussion would be different when their heart rate went back to normal. And what the lab found was that once the heart rate went back to baseline, the couples behaved like different people. They could listen better. Their sense of humor returned. If they had a sense of humor, it returned. They didn't have it, Gornish tells them. They became more creative problem solvers. Reducing physiological arousal is very important for productive fighting. Take a break. Call time out. Calming down is an important part of the equation. But I just want to give you a tip from the trench. If you are taking a break and you feel flooded, you can't just say, I'm too upset. I heard that lecture about fighting. We're not talking about this anymore, and storm out. Because your partner will feel completely shut down, completely pushed away. You have to schedule at that time, a time when you're going to reconvene and discuss it in a calmer fashion. You can say, let's talk about this later, I'm very upset, after dinner, when the kids are in bed. It's always better when the kids are in bed anyway. Or let's talk about it tomorrow morning, after we're both rested and we're not so tired. Since occasional conflict is an inevitable part of marriage, I want to share with you something that I found particularly fascinating about this research. In the lab, the same couples came for over 3 decades, and the experimenters found something shocking. The majority of conflicts, 69% of conflicts, were not resolved. The conflicts perpetuated. The issues were the same year after year. 4 years later, the couples were still talking about the same source of conflict, the same opposing points of view. It seemed as though you pick someone to marry and you've chosen your set of unresolvable marital topics for the next couple of decades. A chronically ill family member, a difficult in-law, financial stress, many problems or conflicts just don't go away. But there were 2 types of responses, 2 types of couples. The couples who talked about them and figured out a way to cope, find a way to live with this perpetual problem. Those were the masters of relationships. And the couples who got divorced because they were constantly fighting about these problems, and they were fighting with contempt, disrespect, criticism, and stonewalling. They experienced the word gridlock. Gridlock is a visual image. I don't know about in St. Louis, but anyone from the tri-state area really has a strong image when we talk about gridlock. Gridlock in marriage means that you feel like you're in this perpetual circle that you can't get out of, and you're stuck, and neither of you can move forward. This research showed something that we already know. Not all stress can be eliminated. 69% actually cannot be eliminated. And the goal is to move out of gridlock, to move to dialogue, to find a way of coping with the problem. How are we going to live with this issue? What's the secret to that? I mean, it sounds very nice, but process. What is the secret to moving past a fight that you're both stuck with? Many arguments have a subtext, a deeper concern than what we're actually fighting about. If we look at the subtext about what we're arguing about, that's the first step to moving beyond the gridlock. For example, what are some of the top, let's pick the top 5 things that most couples fight about? What would you think?
Money.
Oh, wow. Okay, so let's work with that example. And you're right, it is one of the top 5 things, and it doesn't matter, interestingly, how much money people have, whether it's the top 1% all the way down, money is always one of the top 5 that things that people fight about and has a lot of subtexts. So in our example, and this is fictional, we're going to take a couple where the husband always wants to spend, and he wants to now blow his bank account and take them on a really fantastic vacation. And the wife always wants to save. And she's saving for what her husband disparagingly says is saving for a day that will never come. The subtext is not about money. The subtext is about basic philosophical concepts. The subtext is from their childhood, from different childhood experiences, sometimes painful or traumatic childhood experiences. In this case, this fictional case, the young man lived growing up with parents who lived very frugally and always saved, dreaming of the day that they could retire and then travel the world. And then he saw that one of his parents did not live to live out that dream, and he learned that we don't know how much time we have, we need to seize the day, we need to live for the moment. And the wife had a very difficult, completely different childhood. The wife was in a family that had very limited resources, and they lived very much hand to mouth, and she remembers very painful experiences, being evicted from their apartment, not having enough money for things. And to her, there is nothing that she could buy or do that would give her the same gratification as just the security of saving. And we can't really, once we deal with the subtext, we can't really expect someone to just completely give up and give in to our side and completely abandon their fears or their dreams. The subtexts are always in conflicts, are very often issues that are close to our core. And if we listen carefully, calmly, we can hear the subtext. If someone says, "Why did you make that decision without me?" What's the subtext?
I feel left out.
Yes, okay. Maybe they don't feel equal in the marriage. Maybe they have a sense that they somehow are less important. If someone says, "You didn't listen to any of my suggestions," what is the subtext? What could it be? Maybe they don't feel that you respect them. You respect their pain. Maybe they don't feel they're important to you. In conflicts, we have to look at the subtext. And if we look at that, we would say, no wonder you just cannot completely give up your side and change to what I want. You can't give in completely if you're talking about someone's fears or dreams. If we don't look at the core or the issue, the subtext, then we only have gridlock. So how do we do that? How do we uncover the real issue behind the seemingly stupid, trivial thing that we're fighting about? When we're fighting, we have to ask more questions. We are in the habit of stating our opinion when we fight. And when we don't get what we want, we state it again, louder, more vehemently. But if we asked questions, we would be able to find out the dream, the fear, the life story, the subtext behind that fight. Ask yourself, or ask them, why is this your position? Why are you afraid of taking a vacation? Why? Or why is this vacation so important to you? Why are you willing to empty everything in the bank and blow it now? Why don't you want to wait? Only then can they have some sort of possible solution, some sort of compromise, to find a way to acknowledge the fears or honor the dream. For this couple, if they ask the questions, then it's not about the money. They could decide on a compromise. They could figure out what is enough savings to abate her fears, and what is enough spending that he doesn't feel like they're waiting to begin to live. To be able to have this kind of productive conflict, to be able to share our fears and our dreams and our painful childhood experiences, we need intimacy and trust in our marriage. And what is the number one ingredient for intimacy and trust? Believe it or not, it's time. We have this very Western concept of quality time and quantity time. I'm sure in parenting you've all heard that expression, and we have figured out as parents, sometimes the hard way, sometimes the easy way, that with children we kind of need both. We need quality time and quantity time, because we're molding them and we're raising them. But our spouses became pretty much fully formed, though some spouses are trying to re-raise their husbands or wives, but it's not really a good idea. For the most part, with spouses in marriage, we really settle for only quality time, and often not that much of it. We instinctively invest in our children. It's part of our maternal-paternal mechanism. And we have to invest in our work. If we're not productive, we're not successful. But it's not instinctive to invest in our marriages. And when we're pulled by many, many demands of children, jobs, aging parents that all require us to invest time, energy, attention, how much more time, energy, and attention do we have to invest in our marriages? And very often it's not until we are empty nesters or until we're retirees that we finally have quantity time. And to put it delicately, many couples find that it becomes too much of a good thing. It's interesting that now there is suddenly a great deal of research being published and media attention on a whole new set of statistics. It appears that the American divorce rate over the past 20 years has stabilized or even tapered off slightly, but the divorce rate of those 50 and above has doubled. Doubled in the past 20 years. They are called the gray divorcees, a topic that's widely discussed with psychological research being published and an article recently in the Wall Street Journal, another article in the New York Times, a book that has just come out about this statistic with all kinds of contributing variables to why this is the case. But one aspect is clear. We need to anchor the years that lead up to that stage of life maintaining this connection. Because couples can get into a groove of moving past each other, like ships passing in the night, each putting out their own fires. And at first they may just forget to consult with each other because life is too busy. Oh, I made that decision, I forgot to tell you, I hope it's okay. But eventually they become more and more independent, and then they're less intertwined, and it becomes harder to reconnect. We mentioned the special challenges of the 21st century in marriage, and one of them is this ability to commute. The fact that people can commute from Israel or can commute from different states and still remain married creates its own set of challenges. So quality time and quantity time has to be a priority. And couples who feel that they're limited by both time and money can be creative. It doesn't have to be a whole evening out. You could trade babysitting with a neighbor and just go for a walk or have a picnic on the park bench. It's really just about reconnecting. When I speak to couples, they always pull out that trump card. They say, well, we have Shabbos. We don't have our cell phones on Shabbos. And if we do, we're not going to tell you about it. We have this wonderful quality time on Shabbos. But when you really analyze your Shabbos, if I asked you to write a time log on how you spent your Shabbos, you would be shocked at how little quality time you have one-on-one with each other until, again, you're empty nesters. Because there's the children, and perhaps you're fortunate enough to have grandparents in the area, and there's simchas, and there's shul, and then there's the kiddush. The kiddush takes a lot of attention. And we just get pulled in a lot of directions on Shabbos. Next time you're out with your spouse, look around at other couples and notice how many of them, rather than talking, are looking at that smartphone. Right? Very often we can be with someone, but we can be distracted. We can be in that mindset that I've called the email voice. Right? Have you ever called someone and you can tell that they're on the phone but they're not completely yours? That email voice. And very often couples fall into a groove when their time together is not really focused on. There's a scene from The Godfather where they all have to go speak to the Godfather and they take out their weapons. Right? So in my family, we don't reenact that, we don't become armed, we're not from Texas, but we all take out all our cell phones and our Game Boys and whatever other electronics we have, and we put it on the counter. No one's allowed to bring it to the table. Especially we have a glass table so you can see underneath the table what the cell phone is saying. No texting allowed. We need to invest real time. Why do we need to invest time in maintaining our relationship? Especially when there's so many other demands in our time. After all, you might be saying, hey, we met, we dated, we invested time up front. Let's obstacles in finance. We front-loaded our time with all those dates. Why do we need to maintain it regularly now when we're so busy? We need to maintain that connection because marriages change over time as people evolve over time. Erikson, the famous developmental psychologist, said that people have many stages throughout their life, and each stage has a developmental challenge. And when you meet that challenge, it changes you, it develops you. You develop new perspectives, new opinions, new ways of looking at things, new skills, new knowledge, new abilities that you did not have. Many of you in this room, if you think back to yourself in your 20s and your 30s, there are things about you that really are different than when you were younger. As people evolve, the relationships have to evolve. I've been speaking to people for many years about the subject of dating. And it's very interesting to me, because when I speak to young people about dating and relationships, I always ask them to list the top three things they're looking for when they're dating. When they're being set up and someone says, I have a nice boy for you, I have a nice girl for you, what are the first three things you ask? And no matter how large the audience, no matter how modern or yeshivish, it could be the Upper West Side, it could be a yeshivish crowd, the three things, the three top factors are always the same. When they get honest, they say they're looking at looks, they ask how the person looks. They may be embarrassed to ask it first, but they ask it. They ask what their professions are they, what are their goals? Are they learners, are they earners, are they going to graduate school? Does the woman want a career? And then they ask the third thing, hashgacha. And then I ask in this audience, which sometimes has hundreds of young people, I say, okay, these are the things you're looking at. Let's start with looks. Raise your hand if your parents look exactly the same as they did in their wedding album. And of course, thank goodness for me, none of them raise their hand because I certainly don't. And then I ask, okay, what about their professional goals? Raise your hand if your parents are in the exact same professions that they planned to be in. The people who wanted to be Clay Kodesh are Clay Kodesh. The women who wanted careers are women are in careers. And surprisingly, most people do not raise their hands. The parents' professions have shifted. Very often lawyers are now social workers, social workers are now lawyers. That seems to be a very common swap, right? People's goals change, people retrain, women decide to stay home, women who are home decide to go into careers. And then I ask, well, what about hashgacha? Right? Are they the same exactly as they were when they got married? And to the surprise of these young people, 95% of the people's hands stay down. That people, they get inspired, they grow, they become disillusioned, they step back from what they learned in Israel. People are changing as life affects them. And just like no one is going to look the same as they did at 70, as they did when they were 20, that's very symbolic of the changes that take place inside of them as well. They have new skills, new interests, new friends. And your marriage needs to maintain connectedness so that you can understand the growth in your partner as this change unfolds subtly over many years. Imagine a boy meets a girl in college, the old-fashioned way, right? The boy meets the girl in college, and he knows her, right? He dated her through college, he fell in love with her, he knew all her friends, he met her friends for inspection, he knew what teacher she liked, her dreams, her stresses, which probably were getting into graduate school. And now she's been home raising their children for 30 years. She's 55 years old. What are her dreams now? What are her stressors? Certainly getting into graduate school isn't one of them. Who are her friends? Not the same friends probably as were in college. What are her hopes now? What are her dreams for herself now? We need to stay in touch with that person all those years so that we will understand them 30, 40, 50 years down the road. Another way that masters build intimacy is through capitalizing on tiny moments. What Gottman called bids for attention, serendipitous moments. When your partner comes to you and says, look at this amazing
amazing article I just read. Or, wow, look out the window. This may be Embassy Suites run by the KGB, but we have a nice view. There's two responses that their spouses could have. Either the spouse could look up and say, wow, look at those boats. Let's sail away someplace together. I would love to just sail away from my job, you know? Or, wow, this is a cool article. Thank you, I'm going to read this. Or the spouses could not bother to look up. They're in the middle of something. They're reading the newspaper. They're looking at their email on their smartphone, and they don't look up. They don't respond to what's called a bid for attention. In this lab, they found that if someone reaches out for your attention and you do not respond, the chances of them rebidding fall to 20% to try to get your attention again. Right? They do some face-saving activity, they kind of crumple up a little bit, and they don't try again so soon. Because spouses are not like toddlers that say, mommy, daddy, daddy, louder and more insistently until you have no choice but to put down what you're doing and notice them. Spouses are more like teenagers. Teenagers come into the room, and if you don't look up from the email, you've lost the chance. They'll turn around and they'll walk away. So masters of relationships are grabbing tiny shared moments to build intimacy. So to summarize, because I know we've touched upon a lot of things today, we're going to summarize the five behaviors that we learn from the masters of relationships, things that we can hopefully take home today and apply in our own lives. One, the masters are building a culture of fondness and admiration, communicating respect and affection, and doing it often, ideally 5-to-1. Positive behaviors to negative behaviors. You're welcome to email me. I'll leave my email here so you can let me know what your ratio is after you do the experiment. 2, masters of relationships learn to have productive conflict, to step back, to reduce flooding so they can problem solve effectively and not destructively. 3, even the worst source of conflict, issues that we fight about all the time, can lead to closeness if we open our mind to understand the subtext, the life story, the fear behind the conflicts, and try to honor their concerns. 4, masters are investing in their marriage. They're investing time. They're staying connected with each other because change is inevitable. And we want to stay connected to them throughout those changes, throughout the years. 5, masters are building intimacy through the serendipitous moments by responding with their full attention, by looking up on their smartphones to the bids for attention so they can share their life's moments. And I'll end with one last thought that I use in my own life, and maybe it'll be inspirational to you too. Because when all is said and done, every positive relationship that you have in your life is a gift. Your friends, your spouse, parents, these are gifts. And we're not automatically entitled to have these people who care about us. The term the me generation that we hear so much about in American culture implies entitlement. It implies someone who feels that they're entitled to the good things they have, and that they therefore not appreciate them properly. But to be entitled and to not appreciate things, that's not a Torah perspective. Everything we have as Jews, we are taught to thank Hashem for. From the smallest gift, an apple, to the biggest gift, marriage, a baby, there are brachas. Brachas that we have to say out loud to thank Hashem for these amazing things. And the brachas are meant to remind us that we're not automatically entitled and that we have to express our gratitude out loud. Perhaps these brachas can also remind us of how to build a marriage. If we realize deep down that this person who truly cares about you and worries about you and rejoices for you is a gift, then you can't keep that gratitude in your head. It can't be implied. To build your relationship, you have to express that gratitude out loud.
You have to look at that person who loves you and say, thank you.
Thank you.
When I speak ordinarily, I really like to take questions, but when we're speaking about marriage, which is somewhat of a sensitive topic, I know what's going to happen. People are going to raise their hand and they'll say, my marriage is perfect. This is about my neighbor's marriage. So to prevent any kind of embarrassment, I'm going to stay behind. I know they're going to be dawdling now in my satellite office of the front hall there. And if you have any questions, please feel free to come by. Thank you again so much. Thank you.